"Hey, keep moving," Gunther asked loudly to the crowd of people waiting.
"Shut up, Gunther," his wife Maria admonished him.
The couple from Magdeburg had been standing in the long queue in front of the old Cologne Cathedral for hours. They had walked 450 kilometers to get here. Often less than 30 kilometers a day, they had been on the road for 20 days. And now they had been queuing here for what felt like an eternity and simply couldn't get into the cathedral. The only way into the building was through a small gate and then through a narrow corridor. It was the only entrance for pilgrims, and at the same time the only exit for pilgrims as well. Streams of people going back and forth further delayed the entry. "It can't go on like this," thought Gunther and Maria. It was an extremely sunny day and the heat was almost unbearable. Street vendors were earning a fortune by selling food and, above all, drink to those waiting to see the relics of the three holy kings. And yes, it was true. Here in 1248, people in Cologne finally agreed, "It can't go on like this. We need a new cathedral, a larger cathedral. A cathedral that could meet the demands of the large streams of pilgrims, one that does justice to the magnificent shrine of the three wise men, a magnificent cover, so to speak, for the golden shrine itself, which in turn held the precious relics inside." Something new was needed. The tallest building that had ever existed. We haven't paid enough tribute to the old cathedral in this podcast. The Cologne Cathedral? Before the Cologne Cathedral, so to speak. We only talked about it when it was built sometime in the 9th century. Then, over the centuries, we have occasionally reported on the fact that it was extended under Archbishop Bruno in the 10th century, for example. Otherwise, never really. Oh yes, that Archbishop Anno II hit here when a mob tried to lynch him in 1074. And yet, the time of the old cathedral slowly comes to an end in our podcast here in the middle of the 13th century. At least, the eastern part of it. We'll get to why that is later. So what are we going to do in this episode? We say goodbye to one of the most impressive buildings of medieval Germany, a building that was demolished without direct necessity. We talk about the expectations and considerations that people had for a new cathedral and observe how the demolition of the old cathedral almost ended in a fiasco, a tragedy that almost permanently destroyed Cologne's status as a holy city, as a pilgrimage center. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows, from the Roman up until our present time. Let's go back to Gunther and Maria, who had been waiting for hours to finally get into Cologne Cathedral, slowly but steadily. They squeezed through the small double-winged gate into the church building to the west. Here in the west of the cathedral was the west choir, which was a few steps higher than the rest of the floor in the nave. The couple's eyes needed a moment to adjust to the new lighting conditions. Only through 12 small arched windows in the nave under the roof does some sunlight enter the interior of the building. Meanwhile, the two of them are repeatedly bombed into others by pilgrims, either unintentionally or perhaps intentionally. You know how crowds get when they want to move on. The whole entrance here is a bit chaotic, Gunther and Maria think to themselves. Once their eyes have adjusted to the light, they can see the interior of the church in front of them, which stretches straight ahead to the east. Far back to the east, about 100 meters away, the eastern choir rises, just like its western counterpart, a few steps above the cathedral's other floor level. In the west, the choir is dedicated to St. Peter, in the east to St. Mary, and both choirs have a crypt below them. Which is sometimes strange for us 21st century people. There are no wooden chairs or seat rows lined up inside the cathedral. They simply don't exist at all at that time. This is not primarily because people used to like to be uncomfortable during church service and prefer to stand all the time. No, the church as a place of spirituality was structured very differently to how we know it today, whether from our own experience or through movies and television. This everyone sits in tight rows on pews, one behind the other, and watch the priest and his altar service for a while, mostly passively, with a few exceptions of course, is a more recent development. The church service as a theatrum sacrum, so a sacred theatrical performance as we know today, first appeared in the Baroque period, so much later than where we are now. So there are no pews here. Theoretically, Maria and Gunther could therefore move around the church completely freely, in theory that is, because as I said, spirituality was practiced in a completely different way here. The entire church is dotted with not just one, but several altars and chapels, as well as associated relics and prayer stations. The faithful always make their way to the next altar or reliquary, as if on a walk within the space to pause and pray for once in a while. And there, too, there was always a queue. So moving around freely is not really possible, despite the lack of pews. So not only do you do a pilgrimage through the countryside or the region you travel through, but also in the church itself at that time. Due to the cramped conditions in church buildings, it was sometimes necessary to erect a wooden stand directly next to the church itself, where pilgrims and worshippers were then shown the relics to worship in open air. This was simply to counteract the lack of space sometimes in church buildings. However, I am not sure whether this also applied to the old cathedral in Cologne, but other places it really was a thing. And while nowadays it is customary for a church service to be held loudly and with great spectacles such as singing, loud praying, bells, consecration chimes, church bells and organs, things were very differently in the Middle Ages. In a church building like the old Cologne Cathedral, several services were sometimes held at the same time, and this was done in small groups, modestly, all standing, and above all, many times, in total silence. This meant that several church services could be celebrated at the same time, in close proximity to each other. One group stood in front of a relic, and directly next to it, at an altar in a small chapel, another group stood within earshot and celebrated another mass, and right next to it, a baptismal font, a baptism service was also taking place at the same time. Could all be happening at the same time. Slowly but steadily, our two people, Maria and Gunther, can move around the old cathedral that was built in the 9th century. Unfortunately, it is not possible for me to say what stood where in which place in the predecessor building of Cologne, nowadays Cologne Cathedral. This is only possible in isolated cases, and I will get to that soon. The layout of the old cathedral was typical of a Carolingian church building from the 9th century. The nave was rectangular, and there were two further corridors on each side which were bordered by a row of pillars or columns. The church thus had, in the 13th century, five naves. On the capitals, so the upper and end of the pillars of columns, there were round arches that supported the ceiling. Once again, I would like to refer to you to my homepage, where you can watch a video with a very clear reconstruction of the old cathedral, and it may help you more than my descriptions here via audio. The ceiling, or rather the roof, was covered with a flat wooden roof. There were only a few small arched windows under the ceiling, as I already told you, and this meant that light, natural light, entered the interior of the building only very sparsely. The exterior of old Cologne Cathedral that was made of a stone was plastered, and the interior was probably extremely splendid. The floor alone took the breath away from the couple from Magdeburg. It was decorated with colorful tiles and shapes. How do we know that? Well, on one hand, you can see parts of the old cathedral's floor up close today. This is possible during a guided tour of the excavation zone under Cologne Cathedral. I must do this again in the near future. Of course, I've put some pictures of that floor on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. Furthermore, even the beautiful Hellenos Codex from the 11th century has captured the old cathedral in a beautiful book illumination. It depicts the canon Hellenos, the Cologne Cathedral canon Hellenos, presenting the same codex to Saint Peter, the patron saint of the cathedral, in his honor. Above him is a largely true-to-scale depiction of the old cathedral, and at its feet is the exact shape and design of the floor that we can still see today in the cathedral excavation itself. How great is that? As I said, it is no longer quite clear where which objects stood in the old cathedral, but we do know with great certainty where the shrine of the three holy kings, or the three magi, stood. In the middle of the cathedral, of course. And we know this not only because we can assume that the highlight of the cathedral would have such a prominent place, but also because there is archaeological evidence to prove it. Traces of a fence can be seen in the excavation zone on the Cologne Cathedral to protect this precious treasure, the shrine of the three wise men, the three wise magi, and above all, to protect the relics located in there. It had a fence around it, as protection against theft, but also against pilgrims who coming too close and possibly damaging it with their behind. But where were the other important relics located? For example, the staff of St. Peter, or the chains of St. Peter, or were they kept somewhere else and only taken out on holidays? I have no idea. But nowadays, you can find both right next to each other in the Cologne Cathedral treasury. At last, Mary and Gunther, our couple from Magdeburg, the pilgrims, are attending in front of the Shrine of the Three Kings, or rather in front of the altar that has been erected for this purpose and stands directly in front of it. It is beautifully crafted, the shrine and also the altar, and does not, the shrine, not shine quite as golden as it could due to the dim light inside the building. This is really a matter of faith, because even if the shrine is precious, the most precious thing from a theological point of view, especially for the faithful, remains hidden for the eye. The bones of the Magi are not visible, concealed behind the magnificent cover made out of gold and diamonds. I myself have never seen them live, only in photos, but you can see the bones every year between January 6th and 12th, when the shrine is opened for 7 days. I really have to do that one day. The two from Magdeburg have saved the shrine of the three wise men for last inside of the cathedral. They slowly make their way through the crowds in the building. When they emerge into the daylight again, the sun blinds them. "Come on," Maria said to her husband, "let's go and get something to eat. It's taken us ages to get here, and I'm sure you're hungry too." "Not so fast," replies Gunther. "We mustn't forget to buy our pilgrim's badge so that everyone knows we were here." Well, souvenirs are probably as old as mankind itself. I think this is also a good opportunity to say goodbye to Maria and Gunther, to wish them a pleasant stay in Cologne in the year 1248, and of course, a safe journey home. Cologne at that time is famous for its numerous relics, and they flock to Cologne in large numbers. And since the three wise men, the relics of the three wise men, the Magi, have been in the city since 1164, the numbers of visitors have increased massively. The city, but above all, the old cathedral was bursting at the seams. The pilgrims stayed overnight in the hostels of the hospitals of numerous monasteries and convents in the city, bringing them additional income. Street vendors sold food, drink, and pilgrim badges, small metal plaques cast in advance. Almost every inhabitant in the city profited from the pilgrims and was able to earn money from them. Pilgrimages are the mass tourism of the Middle Ages and early modern times. In his chronicle about the three wise men in Cologne around the year 1200, an unknown contemporary author refutes the cliché that people in the High Middle Ages never travelled and also remained poor and sad in their village. He speaks of sheer masses of people who came to Cologne, like Scotland, Brittany, England, France, Italy, or even Spain, to see the relics of the three wise men. Sounds almost like today, only with 6 million people a year visiting Cologne Cathedral and looking at the shrine. It's a little more than 800 years ago, and the audience has become even more international nowadays. But I'm sure you realize what I've been hinting at all along. The old Cologne Cathedral was a magnificent building, perfectly intact, richly endowed, well attended, and considered one of the most magnificent cathedrals in the empire. For many contemporaries, however, the 500-year-old building was getting, well, old. The proportions and architecture of the building could no longer keep up with the mass tourism of the 13th century. So after a short break, let's take a look at what was envisioned for a new cathedral in Cologne, above all who decided on it, and what they decided on. If you come from Cologne or live in the city, you may be familiar with this. Many things in this city, nowadays, simply take far too long, are planned for too long, discussed for too long, and above all, built for too long. This already happened in the run-up to the planning of the new Cologne Cathedral at the beginning of the 13th century. In our mind game with Maria and Gunther, we were in the year 1248. We jump back around 25 years to the year 1225 at the time of Archbishop Engelbert of Berg. In that year, the chief shepherd of Cologne from the powerful regional dynasty of the Counts of Berg was at the height of his power. What does a ruler do at the height of his power? Right, he or she wants to immortalize him or herself for posterity. As early as 1225, Engelbert realized that the old Cologne Cathedral was too small, but the decision to build a new cathedral was not in his hands, despite all his power as Archbishop, Duke, Imperial Prince, and Count of Berg, because, you know it from previous episodes, the Cologne Cathedral belongs to itself. At that time, it was represented by the Cathedral Chapter, headed by 24 full members, 16 of them from the high nobility, 8 of them, at least, highly educated clerics who maybe studied in Paris or somewhere else. In the year 1225, Engelbert is talking to the Cathedral Chapter all the time. He says, "We need a larger cathedral." He had done a lot of persuading and had probably almost managed to get a vote for it. But then, in the same autumn of 1225, you know what happens from a previous episode, he went on a trip where he was murdered by his relative Friedrich of Isenburg and his servants. And the idea of building a new cathedral was put on ice for the time being. But now, in 1248, the Cathedral Chapter cannot move fast enough suddenly. The rich and mostly aristocratic members of the Cathedral Monastery are united in their vote. In April 1248, they decide to build a new cathedral. And what a cathedral! Do you remember the episode about the Romanesque century in Cologne? The century from around 1150 to 1147, when the Romanesque architectural style really blossomed once again in the city, both in terms of secular buildings, such as the beautiful Romanesque Oberstolzenhaus, which you can still see today in Rheingasse behind Heumarkt Square, a building built for the patrician family of the Oberstolzen, or, for example, the 12 large Romanesque churches that you can still see in Cologne. In 1247, 1 year before the decision was made to build a new Cologne Cathedral, Cologne's Romanesque century came to a brilliant end. St. Cunibert, located in the north of the city directly on the Rhine, was completed and consecrated in the same year. To mark the occasion, Archbishop Konrad of Hochstaden threw a big party for the Cologne clergy and many other members of the high nobility. Surely, it is obvious that the new cathedral building will also be Romanesque? No, of course not. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about the Romanesque century ending in Cologne in 1247 nowadays. I personally, don't get me wrong please, love the Romanesque architectural style. That's one of the reasons why I'm a member of the Cologne Romanesque Churches Association and support it with money. But the architectural style also provided those characteristics that I personally really like, but that are no longer fashionable in the old cathedral in the middle of the 13th century. and that is small doors, small windows, round arches that don't allow you to build that far up that you're building, thick walls and pillars that restrict the view through the church interior when you're in a side aisle, for example. Yeah, all that is not wanted anymore. But in order for everything that the Romanesque style has offered so far to be perceived as no longer cool, there must of course be something that can serve as a counterexample. And there are already several inspirations on site in Cologne itself that are already structurally in place, visible for everybody to see. So when the decision was made to build a new cathedral in 1248, the mendicant orders were already firmly integrated into Cologne's urban society, above all in the form of the Franciscans and Dominicans. Both were characterized by their vow of poverty, which was taken very strictly, at least at that time, and their work as, yeah, mendicant orders, so to speak, literally. They placed particular emphasis on preaching, education, and pastoral work in cities, in contrast to the traditional, often rural monastic orders like the Benedictines, oh, I can't pronounce it, I'm so sorry. And of course they, the mendicant orders, built churches for this purpose in cities. In 1248, the Franciscan monastery church had already been under construction for 2 years, today's Minoritenkirche in Cologne, or Minorit Church in English, I guess. A completely new way of building was already evident here when it was built, a style that had been copied from France. But this style could also be seen in existing churches as well. The two Romanesque churches of St. Apostle and St. Mary in the Capitol had pointed arches instead of the previous Romanesque round arches, extending their already existing buildings to heights never imagined before. Wouldn't it be cool to build a church entirely in this new style and not only use it as an extension of an already existing building? Well, you might have guessed it. I've beaten about the bush enough. When talking about pointed arches, it is clear that I'm talking about the Gothic architectural style. Just a quick note. Like the term Romanesque, Gothic is also a term that only emerged much later and was even invented as an insult. During the Renaissance, the Gothic style was considered barbaric, so that Italian art theorists in particular described it as barbaric, Gothic pejoratively named after the Germanic Goths from late antiquity. Renaissance followers in Italy thought antiquity was much better, while north of the Alps, what would later be called the Gothic style was still in fashion, so to speak, with the late Gothic developments going on in art, architecture, and everything else. Nowadays, in my opinion, the term Gothic has lost its negative connotation. On the contrary, Gothic is really beautiful, but back then in the 16th, 17th century, Gothic was meant as an insult. The later-born Renaissance artists did the Gothic style an injustice, as its origins lie in the French cultural area and not in the so-called barbaric German lands. The people of the Middle Ages did not call it Gothic, obviously. It was simply the new architectural style. For the sake of simplicity for my dear listeners, however, I will continue to refer to this style as Gothic. This new style, Gothic, flourished around Paris in particular in the beginning. It is not always entirely clear exactly how the Gothic style, which represented an architectural revolution, came about. The best documented starting point, however, was the year 1140, when the abbot of the monastery of Saint-Denis near Paris simply came up with the idea of building differently. He wanted to bring light into the church. With big windows as much as possible, the interior should be higher as well and far more delicate and visible. The new monastery church should no longer rest on thick walls and round arches. Instead, the weight was to be distributed over numerous but thinner pillars and columns. However, as the higher buildings are built, the more pressure they exert on the load-bearing walls. So, what did they do? Not only build walls, but they also built buttresses, what a funny word, I've never heard before in English, that would support the building to, divert the whole weight of the building. The same applies to the ceiling, where cross vaults are used to balance the massive weight on the walls below. The result is not just a building with walls on each side as before, like a normal house you might live in, but almost a skeletal structure that clearly, cleverly, distributes the weight of the building through many places. And this means, with that, you can build much higher, bigger, and further than ever before. A significant advance in architecture. It's a revolution, guys. Even the ancient Romans, as cool as they are, would have never been able to build that great. If all this doesn't mean anything to you now, or you can't imagine it visually, what Gothic style looks like, of course, I'll put pictures of all that, of all those Gothic elements, on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. There also you can find, in a previous blog post, what the characteristics of the Romanesque style was. And since, contrary to what is assumed, people in the Middle Ages did travel and exchange ideas, the Gothic architecture's style arrived in the most diverse corners of Europe, and in the Rhineland too, of course, with the proximity to France. But just as with the Romanesque style, the same applies here too. Gothic is a style that is diverse and changing, it has regional characteristics, and is not limited to architecture alone. Painting, sculpture, book illumination, literature, and yes, music. However, we will stick to architecture for the most part here. It is also no wonder that the Gothic style made such a rapid triumphal march through Europe. Paris and France itself were the centers of education during this period. Since the fall of the Western Roman Empire, it has been the clergy who have preserved and developed the knowledge of antiquity to the best of their ability, although, of course, mostly under religious aspects. Of course, this also applies to architecture and the art of building. It may come as a surprise from today's perspective when we think of monks or priests as merely praying people. However, those of them who studied back then in Paris were well versed in many arts, like architecture, and they would really know how to build things. We will soon get to know a famous Cologne monk who lived at the time we are right now, when the foundation stone of the new Cologne Cathedral was laid, for whom this is more than a little true, that he was really mastermind for his time, maybe the Albert Einstein of medieval Cologne in Germany. In this way, even the clergymen who had studied Gothic style brought their knowledge back to their home country after completing their studies, for example, like in Paris. Another factor favoring the Gothic style, after all, much more building material and people and more complicated construction methods needed to be used, was of an economic nature. The warm period of the High Middle Ages, with better farming methods, resulted in large agricultural surpluses. This means that much more food is produced and fewer people are needed to produce food on the fields or in the countryside. So much so that the population can still increase and still workers were available on the labor market in the cities who are not necessarily needed for agriculture. So would anyone like to build large stone cathedrals? Yes, of course, we have time, we have the money, and we have the food for that. So the Cologne Cathedral chapter wants a Gothic cathedral. No wonder, as many of them studied in Paris themselves and were able to experience the new architectural style at first hand. But what the members of the Cologne Cathedral chapter plan borders on megalomania. They don't want to build a cathedral, they want to build the cathedral, on such a scale that long after the end of the Middle Ages, when the building was finally completed after a 600-year delay in 1880, yes, you heard right, it was still the tallest building in the world for a very short time. From 1880 to 1884, Cologne Cathedral was the tallest building in the world. Only the Washington Monument since 1884 was the tallest building then. And it was then replaced in 1889 by the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And another thing that comes to mind, the floor of Cologne Cathedral is so large that it can fit, when the people stand in it, it can fit 20,000 people. So at that time, it means that everybody who lives in Cologne, or at least, let's say, three-quarter of Cologne, could fit into that cathedral, if it was finished back then in 1248. And later on, Cologne would have 50,000 citizens, inhabitants, but that's another story for later, for the late medieval period. But at that time, in the 13th century, Cologne had around about 20,000 to 25,000 inhabitants. And Cologne Cathedral would have been able, if it was finished in 1248, and now I'll repeat myself, would have been able to fit every human being in the city into that building. There's no comparison to that. Even the Circus Maximus in Rome, which was really, really big and great, with 250,000 seats, could only fit a quarter of the city's population. And just think about a city like Tokyo or Beijing with 20 million people. Even today, Cologne Cathedral is the third tallest church in the world. It is only around 70 centimeters away from the second place and 4.15 meters from the first place. And hear me out, people, I really wonder, can we put just something else on top of Cologne Cathedral to get back to number one? Maybe? Now, you think we are going to start building and how exactly it was done in 1248, but look slowly at the clock. We should slowly come to the end of this episode, and we'll do that with a great spectacle, or rather, a tragedy. As I said, dear people, how to build a cathedral like that, and who does it, and how, we will find out another time. But before you can build something new, of course, the old has to be demolished. How do you do that in the Middle Ages? Well, there are no excavators, no wrecking balls, or explosives yet. You could take the whole thing down with tools and lots of hands. Quite laborious, and that takes time. So one comes up with a seemingly great idea. Why not simply dig tunnels under the old cathedral, shore it up with wood, and then set it alight? The tunnel would collapse, and so would the building above it. There's just one small problem. Of course, they want a new cathedral to be able to welcome more pilgrims, but the current stream of pilgrims should also continue to come to the city while the new building is on its way. So the cathedral chapter decided on a typical Cologne compromise. Only half of the old cathedral was to be demolished, roughly speaking. The eastern part would then be rebuilt with a Gothic choir. In the western part, pilgrims could continue to pay homage to the three kings and all the other saints and their relics in the nave and the west choir of the still existing old Cologne Cathedral. And in the middle of the building, a large wooden partition wall is built to separate the eastern part, which is to be demolished, from the western part that should remain for a few decades or even centuries. Perfect plan, right? Oh dear. On April 27th, the time has come. It takes the workers 3 days to undermine the eastern section. On April 30th, the tunnels are set on fire. Everything seems to go well. The fire causes the wooden supports to collapse below the cathedral, and the eastern section of the old cathedral collapses with a great roar. However, the fire is not smothered during the collapse and engulfs the collapsed rubble. Before the bystanders can extinguish the fire, the strong winds during that day blowing carry the fire to the wooden partition wall. There, the fire finds enough fuel to set the entire wooden partition wall ablaze from the floor to the top. And then, oh horror, spreads to the wooden roof truss of the western section. The entire old cathedral was now burning. I think that all of you, no matter how old you are or where you come from, because it's not that far ago, are still familiar with their images of the burning Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, a tragic event. I nearly cried that day. Even the most modern fire departments, with all their technology, experience, and machinery, had to use all their strength to fight this complicated fire in 1219, and it took them hours to get the fire under control. So, but we are in the Middle Ages, not in 2019. And it's a real catastrophe for Cologne that took place here on April 30th. The whole Cologne, the old Cologne Cathedral, is burning. And don't forget, in the western part of the building are still all the relics for which the pilgrims come to the city and provided with inconsiderable income. And above all, the Shrine of the Three Wise Men is among them. The new cathedral is being built just for them, for those relics. If they get lost in the fire, oh dear, it is simply impossible to express what a tragedy that would be. A monk from Saint Pantaleon recorded the whole thing and wrote the following about it. Quote, "When the Cologne Cathedral chapter had come to a conclusion about the complete demolition of the cathedral and the reconstruction of a better building with the approval of the archbishop and the priors, and the workmen had very quickly undermined the eastern part of the church walls, they carelessly set fire to the beams supporting the cavity with too much food for the fire, so that the load resting above them quickly collapsed. The fire, which grew stronger with the rising wind, completely consumed the noble, albeit old, church, down to the bare walls and the two golden chandeliers hanging inside. However, the power of God was clearly demonstrated by the fact that the Shrine of the Three Kings had been moved from its place in the middle of the church to the entrance before the fire was lit, not out of fear of the fire, but of the danger of collapse. So the shrine was carried out with great difficulty, because the whole church was filled with smoke without any damage and saved undamaged." End quote. Faith moves mountains, literally on this April 30th. A few brave Cologne residents run into the blazing church building, remembering that it is already cramped and dark inside even without smoke and fire. With wet cloths in front of their faces, probably, they get all the relics out of the building at lightning speed and in the nick of time, including the Shrine of the Three Wise Men, which, people, is half a ton, so 500 kilograms. Insane, really. Historical sources tell us that it was so hot in the building that the golden chandeliers in the interior, that was already mentioned, that historical source I just quoted, literally melted and dripped to the floor. But you heard the good news already. The relics were saved. And with them, Cologne's status as one of the most important pilgrimage centers in Christendom. Although the western part was badly damaged by the fire, it was probably quickly restored from May 1248. However, the fire itself was the news in the summer of 1248 that was mentioned everywhere in historical sources. The English King Henry III called on his subjects to donate to the building of the new Cologne Cathedral. He certainly did so out of Christian charity, of course, but also in view of the good trade relations between England and Cologne, maybe as well. And anyone who helped to clear up, demolish, build or rebuild the cathedral automatically received absolution from the Pope in Rome for all sins committed. How nice is that? With this support, both locally and from international players, it was possible to finally lay the foundation stone for the new building in August 1248. But that, dear people, that story we'll do another time. This was the episode where we hopefully said a fitting farewell to the old Cologne Cathedral. It had dominated the Cologne skyline for 500 years. Even in the year of its demolition, it was still considered the, quote, mother and master of all churches in Germany, end quote. And despite its advanced age, it was still highly sought after by pilgrims from all corners of the then known Christian world. We also had a glimpse about what Gothic architecture is. And to be honest, I found it a little bit difficult to describe that architectural style in an audio format, that is best seen live, or at least in pictures or videos. And as I said, I can at least offer you the latter on the homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. That's it for this time. I hope you enjoyed it. I think we'll continue building Cologne Cathedral next time. Because the question is, how the hell do you actually build something like that? And if you think, why are you swearing on your podcast? I'm listening with my child. Well, after all, you're listening to podcasts about human history, which is not always suitable for little children. But no, I'm not only swearing by accident, because the devil indeed really has a hand in building Cologne Cathedral. You don't believe me? Well, then stay tuned for next time. It's a great legend, I will tell you. Many thanks this time to Thomas, Hans, Eric, Norbert, Carla, Antje, Christian, Stefan, and Manfred for your tips via PayPal. Special thanks to Engelbert, I hope you're not the Engelbert from 1225, and Caledonian, who are now giving me a long-term financial support for this podcast as new Patreons. I used a lot of literature and information. Of course, they are all in German. Sorry about that, but those are my sources for this episode. By Georg Hauser, Schichten und Geschichten unter dem Dom, so Layers and History Beneath Cologne Cathedral, the Cologne Cathedral excavation, then the Short Illustrated Architectural History of the City of Cologne by Udo Mainzer, and the same author also wrote a Short Illustrated Art History of the City of Cologne, both called Eine kleine illustrierte Architekturgeschichte der Stadt Köln und Eine kleine illustrierte Kunstgeschichte der Stadt Köln. Cologne in the High Middle Ages by Karl Dietmar and Hugo Stehkämper were also used, of course, so Köln im Hochmittelalter by Karl Dietmar und Hugo Stehkämper. Kirchenbau im Mittelalter, so church building in the Middle Ages by Dietrich Konrad, was great to understand all those buildings aspects. And from the Reclam Publishing House, very well known to every student in Germany, those little yellow books, volume 4 on the art epochs, talking about Gothic architecture and art, by Bernd Nicolai, was a nice information. I lack the words now at the end of this long episode, as always. But last but not least, a special extra thank you, a really big thank you, goes to the Instagram user called Paupa Peccator. And if you can speak Latin or understand it, this means righteous sinner. His Instagram handle is Peregrinatio Religiosa, which is also Latin and just means pilgrimage. He likes to remain anonymous. He doesn't want me to mention his name, but he is truly a proven studied church historian. And over the last few weeks, I've had a permanent dedicated line to him and have asked him about everything to do with everyday life in medieval church and pilgrimage stuff. Thank you very much, you righteous sinner. If you are ever in Cologne again, I'll buy you a drink. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Recommend me to others. Have a good time, and as always, auf Wiedersehen.